news time. It's Spence's time for news.
Hey there, cool cats. It's me, Spence. I just realized I'm doing like the complete deadpanist ass face and I'm taking video for this. What's up, guys? Last week, there were some technical problems. We were going to do like a show about tarot. We were going to do like a psychic show. I was being very psychic, but I actually predicted that there was going to be technical issues, and it turns out there were. So, yeah. I just wanted to let you guys know that the next episode is going to be the next episode of Evangelion for Anime Binge Club. So feel free to watch that episode if you want to be prepared for the next thing that comes in the feed. To make it up, we're going to play a classic episode. Oh boy, I'm looking right at the camera because I'm so excited about the classic episode. And I'm so excited about it, I could tell you what it is, and I'm not going to wait for Kevin to randomly pick it and insert it after me talking. Let's go. Hello and welcome to a show. Oh man, what's it called? It's that's right, the Amnesia Power Hour. That's what we're doing. We talk about memory, or more importantly, the I'm Spencer Crittenden, and I'm coming here to you today. I've come to you today. I've come into my room, sat down, and initiated a Zoom call with Kevin.
You sound so excited about that, Spencer.
Yeah, okay, I could take that again. I'm here, you know, I came to my room. I'm so excited to do the show with you. Initiated a Zoom call with Kevin.
Thank you. That was a lot better, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, this is the show now. You know, I'm sure you're asking, man, that Derek Mears episode was a real corker. It was a real, you know, doohickey. And there's got to be some way he's planning on following it up. Like, how is he going to beat that? Well, you know, you just wait and see. That that's not even anything I'm going for at all. If anything, I chose the path of chaos and am going to just do a real terrible show to reset expectations to more manageable levels. But yeah. So what's up, Kevin? How's it going with you?
I was doing good. I just got back from LA, got to meet up with Rob Schraub and Kate for a little bit. Rush back home now and, you know, getting back to work. How's your week gone?
Yeah, so Kevin came out to LA and he sent me a text, you know, you want to meet up for food sometime, you know, maybe we'll do it. And you know, that was, you know, but that must have came after he secured the bag in the form of hanging out with Schraub, his presumably true objective. And you know, I'm more than happy to take Kevin's like sloppy seconds you know, in FaceTime with him because I just care about him so much. But yeah, I guess, you know, really you did what you came to do, which was get FaceTime with the real talent behind Schraub home video. And you know, and you can't always make it work with me, it's fine, you know, I can't offer you anything other than, you know, my unyielding love and affection and support, you know. So what's that worth, like $3?
I did feel really terrible saying, hey Spencer, do you want to hang out, followed almost immediately by, oops, sorry, I'm heading back now.
What was really cool about that to me was I was like, yeah, man, I'm completely free. Like, I don't do shit anymore. I'm super lonely. Please, can we do something? I'll buy you movie tickets. We could go to the beach. Like, please, anything. Please, please. But, you know, honestly, looking back on it, I guess that is kind of an off-putting energy. So, you know, I can't blame you.
Well, all right. I will commit to you. Next time I'm in LA, I'm gonna come a day early, and we're gonna do a that happens in person, like you, yeah, and me together face to face. Like, I haven't seen you since 2019. I don't think, like, in person.
I guess you haven't been looking. I've been here every week. We're right. I'm right here. Look at me. Kevin refuses. If you're listening to the podcast, you need to understand that Kevin refuses to look at me. And in the rare expectations that, you know, the task demands, he kind of turn this way. He puts on a blindfold. Like he thinks, I think Kevin thinks he's blind justice, which, you know, is very progressive, blind justice
classically being a woman, you know, but we're breaking barriers. But yeah, well, what else? What, so you came, what's your life been like? You recently moved, right? What, how'd that go? Like, or how are you settling into the new place? Is it feeling good? Is it feeling like home, or is there projects you have outstanding?
Yeah, no, it's been feeling great. It's been a shock though, because, you know, I moved from like a farmhouse where we never got any trick-or-treaters. And I found out on Halloween that the schools gave out a list of like the best neighborhoods to go to for the most candy. And my little neighborhood is the number one on their list. So I got, and I'm not kidding, over 400 kids coming to my door on Halloween.
Did you have anything?
That was a lot. I went out, once I found out that was happening, I went out early Sunday morning to buy more candy. And I ended up like spending $300-$400 worth of additional candy. And I still ran out.
Trick-or-treaters. That happens. Oh, drink. Remember when we did that on the show?
I do. I grab my drink.
Eagle-eared fans will remember episode 27. I don't know. But what were you sipping on there?
Oh, this is the new Pepsi Soda Shop cream soda.
Do you guys
hear
that?
They have two flavors now. It's a new thing. I didn't even know it existed until I was grocery shopping. And they also have dark cherry.
Wow. While you were saying that, a big crash happened. I got to conduct forensics, but what I believe must have happened is my new Crisp software, my Crisp audio algorithm software that you've generously provided, I think has just deleted that entire crash. So no one could hear it except for me.
I didn't hear it at all.
Or you're gaslighting me. Either way, you know, we talk a lot about gaslighting here when that happens. But yeah, also my cat, she like climbed into a bag of Indian takeout and she was like fucking around. And I guess that somehow led to the crash. I don't know. Who knows? Okay. One more chance. You got one more chance. Anything else that's, you know, new in your life lately?
No, I just finally finished moving. That was the big deal of my year. I think I spent 6 months moving and we're finally done. There's nothing left at my old house anymore. It's listed for sale. I'm done.
Wow. Are you going to buy it?
Buy my own house. that sounds like a clever tax dodge, but no, probably not. I'm going to sell it to somebody else.
That's like something an NFT person would recommend. It's like, if you buy your own house, that's just money in the bank. That's pure profit, baby.
Do you own any NFTs?
No, I don't like NFTs. Okay, so let me rant real quick. I believe there could be a world or an application where NFTs are valuable and have legitimate uses. I believe that it could be the case. And, you know, you might be thinking of me, Spencer, you're stupid. That's stupid. Whatever. Not you, but, you know, the audience. But, you know, the idea of a digital object that can be taken out of its context, its walled garden of technology, you know, the Apple Store or whatever, and then placed into another digital context where it makes sense for that to be a distinct object rather than copies of the object in different walled gardens. I think there could be some use for that. I don't know. And I certainly don't think anyone is trying to find it. And I certainly don't think anyone really wants to make it into a real useful thing. They just, you know, it's like they already made the blockchain. So they're like, how can we get people more invested in the blockchain? What about this? It's not just money. Now it's trading cards, you know? And like, and so I think they're just trying to get people into the economy, and kind of turn people on to it more than they have any real. It's like a solution in need of a problem, you know. To the extent, I don't think Bitcoin or, you know, blockchain is super useful, but if you want to use it for something, money makes some amount of sense, because it's like, at least that makes sense there. You're not just counterfeiting money or whatever. You can track it moving around, whatever. That has some idea to me. But the idea of a digital object or an object that's even not digital, like, I don't really see any reason to do that. Like, you know, I have a Rick and Morty collectible sweater that has a unique identifier number, you know, a collector's number. This is one of 150 or whatever, you know, and it's like that the technology of authentication exists. It even exists in a digital sphere in the form of, you know, two-factor authentication, encryption. You know, there's ways to authenticate systems that don't require the use of a blockchain. But the only reason they're kind of delving into the space is, well, we have this already. What else can we do with it? But they don't have any unique, interesting ideas. Now, you know, are you familiar with the anime Yu-Gi-Oh?
Yes. Not intimately, but yeah, I'm familiar.
So in Yu-Gi-Oh! They have a deck of cards. Then they do these virtual reality cyber duels where they have this thing on their arm that's like a, it's like a game board, essentially, that you place the cards into, and then holograms project those images in reality, and then it looks like you have a giant fucking dragon in front of you, and it punches, you know, a golem in the face or something, you know. So in the world of Yu-Gi-Oh, Yu-Gi-Oh is the most, it's the card game is called Duel Monsters, but it's the most important thing in the entire universe of Yu-Gi-Oh. You know, it's like if someone cheats on your girl, you're gonna duel him in the streets. You know, it's like when a corporate merger is set to take place, you know, the CEOs will duel over the fates of who's gonna control the company. Like, you know, it's like, it's, it imagines a world, you know, a lot of anime does this. It imagines a world where, what if this was the biggest thing in the world? Like the Prince of Tennis is like, what if everyone solved their problems through tennis? You know, whatever. It's just kind of like an anime trope that exists, is like, what if this were everything and all of society were structured around it? If we lived in a Yu-Gi-Oh! World, there could be value in making Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards NFTs that you get. It's there, you can put them into digital, you can take them out and put them into a real physical card. And you know, you don't have to go to one dual disc manufacturer. Maybe you go into a dual arena that's made by this company. And so you take your NFTs into it and plug it into that system. You know, maybe your NFT or maybe your dual monster cards have different AIs because the dragon is more aggressive than the foot soldier. And, you know, maybe having those AIs persist as opposed to being copies of each other based on, you know, your stylistic future aesthetics for needs, for what you need an AI for. Maybe an NFT could be useful in that context, because you take, you know, your home AI out and then you actually put it into your car, and now it's driving your car and the dragon likes to go fast. And, you know, I don't know, you know, like in this crazy future world, I can see where some sort of digital construct that's the bedrock of society, you know, could be used to kind of move around. But generally, there's no reason you can't just copy a digital object and then put it into another context. You know, even from a you know, obviously the supposed goal is decentralization, but you know, no one necessarily wants decentralization as a means to an end. Like, people are fine having their iPad apps be iPad apps and not being on an Android phone, you know, and Apple wants that too. Like, they would rather run, you know, this other system, and then they put their shit in that system, then be all like, oh, you can take this out of our system and put it in a different system. You know, like, there's like, I don't think there's any real incentive. And even consumers, it's more complicated to have the, you know, to have these systems capable of that level of sophistication and modularization, where you can just take out an NFT and plug it into your car, or, you know, take out your trading card and make it your web page, or I don't know. You know, it's like, I just don't see it, like, it's the way things work through at least Apple, like, it functions pretty well for consumers, and they like that there's kind of the only one store. Like, I can, obviously there's problems with monopolization and stuff, but I think like all of that's a value add for a consumer, and plugging into the blockchain is kind of a value subtract, because it just gives you this level of sophistication that you just generally don't need in that kind of is like retrograde to your consumer experience that you want. Like, certainly, you know, you probably know at least a little bit about crypto. Like, using crypto interfaces, wallets and stuff, it's all fucking a nightmare. Like, it's not easy. The best solutions are still at least a little bit of a hassle. Like, if you compare it to, say, like Robinhood or something, like the stock trading app, like Robinhood just works how you expect it to. Whereas like a lot of the storefronts and wallets and stuff just don't, like, that's not what you want. You don't want to be able to lose your password to your money and then you just never have your money ever again. You know, like, there's like a lot of the features are negative features, you know. And so, like, again, I can imagine uses, hypothetical uses of the stuff that actually does provide value, but I just don't see, like, everything you can do with an NFT you could also just do with an encrypted hash code that can be authenticated through a third-party service. Then it's like, oh yeah, this is the real ape. What are they, trash apes or whatever? This is the real trash ape. Look, it has the right code or whatever, you know. And then you don't have to use the blockchain, but you've done the same thing. You can limit the access of the unique hashes and stuff. It, like, there's ways to do this that do the same exact function. They're not necessarily as elaborate because they don't use this intentionally elaborate, but the reason it's intentionally elaborate is because it's supposed to be for money. You know, it's like, you can't You can't take away that security from money. Like, but in trading cards, you don't need it. You know, and that, you know, NFTs are essentially trading cards. And if you don't know what NFTs are, I'm so sorry. It's been what, like 15 minutes of me talking about the ramifications of something you probably don't understand. But yeah, well, do you have a different take? I mean, you know, yeah, I'm open to ideas.
I mean, I think there are some good uses of blockchain technology.
Right.
That, you know, like one good example of it that IBM really kind of pioneered, which is kind of surprising because, you know, everyone thinks of IBM as this just dead company now, right, is the shipping industry. You know, the shipping industry has hundreds of players that do not trust each other. And, you know, when you're moving shipping containers across the ocean, one shipping company wants to know where it came from before and who had it before that and what was in it. And not only what did you tell me was in it, but what did the person who gave it to you said what was in it and things like that. And so by having it all in a public ledger, you don't have to worry about people doctoring their books. Just like, you know, say a shipping container catches on fire, who knew what was actually in it at what point, you know? Because what happens right now is everyone points fingers at each other and goes, well, I told you it was explosives, you put down in your, you know, sheet it was bananas, you're the one who's faking your logs, and then the previous company does the same thing and all that. So this lets everybody have a public record of things, of who said what and when, so that nobody can falsify it, and doesn't require a third party to trust. I think that's a great use of blockchain technology.
Sure. Yeah, you know? Well, that's the thing is, like, the public ledger, again, with money, a public ledger can add value. Obviously, with what you're talking about, it can add a lot of value because it's like you can just see all these movements that happen. Hypothetically, that could be possible, but because it's all these entities that don't have coordinated, you know, logging systems, that's where the problem comes in. Yeah. So, yeah, that's definitely a valid use of it. Sure.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think, like you're mentioning apps, you know, I could see a future where, like, maybe we do move on from everyone using the Steam store for PC games. And when you buy a copy of a game, you buy an NFT directly from the publisher. And then that lets you later, like, I bought this game, I gave the publisher $20 in Ethereum or Bitcoin or whatever. And then 5 minutes later, I said, you know, this game sucks. I can sell it to you, and the publisher still knows that because I transferred it, you know, the NFT from me to you, only one person still has the ability to run the game because it's somehow checking that, you know, my identity has a current key to it or something. I can see uses like that, but you're right. It's more complicated than what we have right now, which is Steam, where there's a single source of truth that you can go to and say who actually owns this game at this point.
Yeah, and also Steam wants that system to persist. And EA, you know, is hardcore on DRM, Steam probably too to an extent. And they don't want you to not, they don't want to lose control of their systems. And, you know, like, there's definitely, like, you know, some people on the cutting edge of technology and awareness and libertarians and stuff that would be like, well, I don't want you to have that power over me. But, you know, I don't think there's enough people like that, you know, who are like, oh, I need video games to not be in a Steam store. I mean, I think we all know it's a monopoly, and it would be nice if it wasn't quite a monopoly. But, you know, you could also just cut down on the monopolistic behavior and still have the same storefronts. And yeah, so, like, that's, again, another use case that I could see being valuable. But then it's like, well, who's even going to push that into existence? I could, you know, I could see value in that, but how much? And, you know, is it worth my time to advocate for and stuff? You know, so yeah, but anything else? Any other ideas?
I mean, not really. I mean, I've liked some of the ideas that people have had about things, like, you know, like, I've heard you just started your Patreon. You could do something where, like, you know, the first 10 people who donate to at some tier get an NFT that on Discord gives them a neat little icon next to them or something. And it's worth more money because you could maybe transfer that, sell it later. You know, when Spencer's Patreon stops selling these things after the first 10 people, do they appreciate, you know, do they become worth more, which will make people pay more for them to you on the hopes that they're going to be able to turn around and flip that one day, and all for just a silly little icon on Discord, you know, stuff like that, where part of the value add is that you can sell this and you're counting on people that it's going to appreciate, but it all still sort of feels like we're all selling tulips to each other and things like that, you know?
Well, that's the thing. It's like when you're talking about a Patreon or something where you get a piece of promotional tchotchke like that I'm selling. I think it's like, we all know what this is. This is a tokenization of you supporting me. You know, this is kind of proof, and you can point to this. And I can see, again, the value for maybe having that online. But it's like, if all it is support, just make it a t-shirt. You know, it's like, I think we need to have, like, a more digital society that's more unified, you know, maybe with this metaverse. You know about the metaverse? Big fan?
Not really.
Yeah. But you know, like, but if it's like Discord is, like you said, it's pretty prominent. But you know, it's only Discord. You know, if you could take that and then put it on Twitter and put it on Facebook, and it's different, you know, it has its own tab of the app rather than it's just a picture that you're putting in a spot, you know, then I could see, but at the end of the day, it's like, I'd rather sell and have physical tchotchkes, even if I can't show them online. You know, I can admit that there's value to showing people online as opposed to having in-person, you know, gear, but I just don't think that people want it to be expensive. It's because it doesn't have a lot of inherent value. And I think that a lot of the things that people are peddling is the idea. It's like, no, this has inherent value. Sure, it's just a JPEG, but it's a JPEG with a number on it. And that's worth $100. And next year it could be worth $200. It's like, no, it's not. You're just making it up. Like, there's no value there. Like, people know what an image costs and it's free. You know, you just download it.
I think this is a reaction though, to people liking the idea of NFTs, and they're not being a good enough market to actually do something with them yet. You know, I mean, it reminds me a lot of the very early days of Bitcoin, though, where people were just like, literally, you'd go onto IRC and somebody would give you 100 Bitcoins in exchange for, you know, saying hi to them or something, just because people just wanted to be able to push the button to transfer them. You know, like, there was that level of demand of, hey, this is such this cool new thing, I want to do it. But the market wasn't there yet. And that's kind of how this feels right now, is that people, you know, for some reason, people are being drawn to NFT. The current use case of it right now, I find kind of silly. People are being drawn to it, though, so they're trying to find a use for it. I think that's what we're seeing today.
Yeah, I just think, like, I can understand the appeal of Bitcoin a lot more, because it's like, let's just play around with this thing, and it's like a fake internet currency, you know, and it's like, it's definitely a financial instrument the same way buying stocks is, but it's like, but these are internet points, they'll give you a Dogecoin or whatever, you know, and it's just like, that's a fun system. But I don't think that there's a lot of inherent fun in what NFTs are. Like, I think that like, people are just trying to sell you on it, and it's like, but there's nothing there. It's like, I can get behind the idea of using this to make something, but what you're showing me is just like, you're just trying to print money, you know, essentially. You're trying to tell me, like, oh, buy this snake oil, I'll be rich. And it's like, we know that so many players are just doing that, you know, and I think that people can get really excited about the specific images or properties being offered, because, you know, art is compelling, you know, it doesn't matter what, you know, you can make a cool little digital pixel art, and that's cool, you know. And so I think, you know, there's value there, but it's just not, it doesn't come from the NFT-ness of it all. It comes from what the thing already inherently was, you know.
Exactly.
Anyway, let's transition to food. What's your food life like, Kevin?
Lately, it's been a lot of DoorDash.
Right.
I've been just like trying new restaurants. You know, there's been so many restaurants that have opened up near me, and it's been a quick way of trying them all. But I love cooking, too. I really, really do. So when I'm not, you know, stuffing my face full of DoorDash deliveries, I'm cooking something.
Are you the cook in the house?
50-50. I mean, Ariel does a lot of cooking. Wow. I do a lot of cooking. But I think it's best when we're both doing it together.
Yeah,
you know, that's when, you know, we'll probably once a week both just like get in each other's way in the kitchen and just make a meal for each other.
Yeah, it's quite an image. It definitely doesn't make me want to shoot myself in the head at all. But yeah, the cooking together sounds like a lot of fun. So first let's hit DoorDash. Any good food, like, you know, you don't have to say restaurants or whatever, but any good types of food that you're finding, any good dishes that you've eaten that are notable, or what kind of vibe is the food scene where you're at right now?
Well, Chicago is pizza, you know, by a long shot. And there's so many pizza places near me. You know, that's what I had yesterday. I've just been trying, you know, try them all. Every bar around here sells pizza, so there's probably, like, you know, I live in the middle of nothing. I probably have 40 restaurants that deliver pizza here. So that's been a lot of it. Do you DoorDash?
I don't use DoorDash. I usually use Grubhub, and to a lesser extent, I use Postmates, but not DoorDash. But, you know, I don't know. Not so much lately. I like to go to a place and pick up my food, even if I'm not eating it at the place. So usually I'll just DoorDash a pickup order. Like, I'll go.
Is that because it's Is that because it's fresher, or do you just like the experience, or?
Yeah, it's the experience. I don't want to eat at home, and I don't want a person to bring me food. Like, I like that trip, I think it's not like it makes the food worse. I mean, it does, but it's not just that. It's like, if I'm eating, if I'm going to go get food, I want to go get food. Like, I want to leave my house. I'm a person who likes leaving my house. I mean, maybe it's, you know, my current living situation, my roommate and stuff, but like, I like leaving the house. I'm like, I'm going to, you know, play video games for 5 hours, and then, man, that was great, and I got to get the fuck out of the house now, you know. And so eating, picking up food is like a huge part of that ritual for me. And I don't just go get food, I go drive around. About halfway through driving around, I usually pull over and order something from the place, and then I go pick it up, you know. That's kind of how I do it. And then I usually eat in my car. I love eating in my car. I love sitting in my car. I love being in my car. My car is my real house in a lot of ways. I don't live out of my car, but I basically live in my car, you know. It's my safe space. It always has been. When I was, you know, living with my parents, it was kind of one of the main ways. I didn't have a ton of friends, so it's like I would either go and hang out at one of the friends, or I would just drive around for like an hour and a half, just because I didn't like being in my house. I didn't like being around my parents. The thing is, you know, and whatever, I was probably living with my parents too late, you know, when I was like old enough to have probably moved out. But you know, they would come when I was at the house, they would come start shit. Like, they would come into my room and start like just bringing stuff up. And it would just start arguments because, I don't know, my family is all like really passive aggressive people. I'm passive aggressive. And so I think this is just what they like, how they operated. It was like, I'm just going to go start shit. And the thing is, if I was not at the house, for instance, if I was at the house 3 hours a day in a day, I wouldn't get as much shit. Like, they wouldn't have the shit in their head and then come to me in the 3 hours I was actually there and then deliver it to my door. You know, if I was gone, the shit would suddenly stop showing up. You know, it's like, it seemed to be a function of me being in the house more than a function of a legitimate grievance that had to be brought out sometime, you know, and then just bad timing or whatever. So like, I don't know. I think I've talked about this, maybe not, but I've come to realize I never really thought of myself as a control freak for most of my life. I've come to realize I think I am a really big control freak, but because I resist being controlled anytime I feel someone trying to control me in any way, I really brush against that. I don't want to like exert control over people in the traditional way, like, you can't do this, like, you should act differently. I don't want to ever give people notes. I would rather exert control by controlling my environment, which is to say, most of the time, just leaving. You know, it's like, if someone's being loud or I don't like someone's behavior, I will not be it. You know, I will not be there for it. I've dumped so many friends just because it's like, I don't want to be part of what you're doing. Like, I don't want that to be in my life. I could never tell you you're doing anything wrong and hope you might change, you know, any of your behaviors. I would rather just completely shut it off and control, you know, who I let in and out. And that is control freak. Kism, you know. It's just not demanding and commanding people to do what I want. It's hoping they do what I want and then running away when they don't, you know. It's not healthy. Passive aggressive, you know. I wish I was better at being assertive and creating conflict when it was necessary, as opposed to just letting things get worse and worse and worse until I feel like I'm gonna explode. Anyway, back to food. I don't know. During the pandemic, I got more into Indian food. Before, I hadn't had very often, and when I got it, I would always get vindaloo, which is fine, but it's just not like, it doesn't really dive into a lot of the good Indian flavors that I like. I mean, you know, I think it's a very white person thing to go like, I like chicken tikka masala, but it's just so good. Like, it's sweet, it's sour, it's tangy, it's got all this spice to it. It's, you know, I get the spicy kind. It's spicy, it's creamy, you know, it's fatty, it's got the acid that cuts it. It's just like a perfect combination. And so like, I've been getting a lot of tikka masala, and that usually I'll get delivered. They give you these little plastic Tupperwares that I use for leftovers and stuff. It's a really good, you know, having those in my life has improved my life because I can cook more now and keep it stored in the Tupperwares and stuff. It's great. What have I eaten lately? I got gyochan as like these Korean wings recently. I went to a barbecue place with my friend Alex Rubens. We got some barbecue. Nothing too big. Lately I've been trying, you know, obviously because of my health scare. I don't know. I've been trying to eat better, but this week that's really fallen off. But, you know, before that, I had been eating a lot of roasted vegetables. I've been roasting vegetables and just keeping them in a big bowl. And then I eat from the bowl like every, you know, couple meals per day. Then they last about a week. And, you know, it's pretty healthy because it's like, you know, maybe I'll get like 200-300 calories of vegetables, but it's really filling. And then I'll have other stuff too, like I have some bread and butter, and I have chicken that I usually get. I'll get a chicken, rotisserie chicken from the store, and I'll just rip it apart the first night, chop it up, and freeze the carcass to make soup out of. And then I'll just keep the chicken in the bag, and sometimes when I'm microwaving the vegetables, I'll throw some chicken chunks and, you know, microwave that. Or I'll make, like, one thing I like to do is make a chicken and butter sandwich, where you just take bread, butter the bread, and then you put, you know, microwaved or cold chicken on it. There's something really good about that for whatever reason. So I do stuff like that. I've been eating a lot of bananas. I've been trying to eat Greek yogurt, sunflower seeds. I eat a lot of spinach if I can. What I've been doing is I've been stacking leaves of spinach in these little piles and then folding them in half and then eating it. And you get all these layers of spinach all at once. You know, not the best, you know, I can saute spinach, but it's, you know, it takes up more room in your stomach if you eat it raw and stuff. So, and, you know, all these foods, sunflower seeds, spinach, Greek yogurt, are supposed to be good for your blood pressure. Who knows? So who knows, in the sense that, you know, science is fake, man. But yeah, that's what I've read. Yeah, so I've been trying to eat better, but this has been a not good week for me. I roasted a bunch of vegetables and I basically haven't touched them. I didn't peel my butternut squash enough, so there's a bit of toughness on the outside of my butternut squash, which is gross. But fuck that up. I'm thinking about what I can do with that, because like I said, I haven't touched it. I'm thinking maybe I can turn it into soup or something. I don't know. You got any ideas?
We just made butternut squash soup. It was delicious. It was so, I didn't think I was gonna like it, and it was so good. I ate all of it. Yeah.
What are the headlines recipe wise? Just butternut soup? Is there cream? Is it like
yeah, it was broth? Butternut squash, cream. I think we use beef broth. Uh-huh. And a little bit of ginger and a little bit of honey. Yeah, and I think those are what really brought it all together.
Yeah, there's a restaurant kind of by my house that makes a really good butternut soup. It has like an acidity, like a sourness to it, that's like an amazing, because, you know, butternut's such a warm flavor. And it's like, it's just amazing. I don't know how they make it, but I'd love to learn how to make that. I've been trying to use my Instant Pot. I make soup in my Instant Pot and it keeps turning out like shit. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing wrong. I think it's just the Instant Pot's bad. But I have two chicken carcasses and I think I'm going to split them up and try and make Instant Pot chicken soup with half of the ingredients and make on the stove chicken soup with the other half, and see, you know, if one is better than the other, or if I'm just fucking the process up really bad sometimes, because soup, homemade soup, is so good. Last Thanksgiving I made ham soup. It was so fucking good with the leftover bone of the ham. It was so good. I ate it for like 2 weeks. It was fucking amazing. It was the best soup I've probably ever had, and I made it myself and I didn't even know what I was doing. I just kind of threw some shit together and it just worked really well. So the idea that the Instant Pot can't make soup is really bumming me out. I have I made risotto in it, which is supposed to be, you know, a very fiddly recipe. People always talk about how hard it is, and there's just an Instant Pot recipe so fucking easy. It takes literally 15 minutes and it comes out perfectly, and there's no fiddling, because instead of you know, the thing about risotto is you put a little bit of liquid in at a time and wait till it all to get absorbed before adding the liquid, so you don't completely swamp the dish. And I think as a result it stays a bit more toothsome than, you know, your average like half hour boiled rice or whatever. But because a pressure cooker can force liquid into a foodstuff, you know, you just pressure cook it for like 10 minutes and it gets you the same exact texture. And then you melt in the cheese and it kind of thickens everything up. And so that was like an unqualified success. It was amazing. I was like, okay, so the Instant Pot is, because thus far I've tried to make soup in it and failed. And I was like, so far this is just a total bust of an appliance, you know. But I'm trying to find, you know, if any fans, if you have any good recipes that you make in an Instant Pot, let me know, because I am trying to figure out, you know, how to win with it. What I'm starting to learn is maybe it's not good for soup, which is forcing flavor out of objects into a liquid, and better for your recipes that are about forcing liquid into an object, you know, to make it more flavorful. Like stewing beef or something, you know, is about kind of like imparting a bunch of vegetable and other earthy flavors into kind of the meat and kind of let, I don't know. I'll figure it out. But yeah, so that's what my food life's been like lately. But you cook. Tell me about your cooking. Like what do you like to cook? Do you like to cook everything? Do you have any things? Like, are you a cooker or a baker?
Well, have you ever played with sous vide cooking before? Do you know what that is?
I'm aware of it, but I've never tried. I keep thinking, like, I see all these ads for like, oh, 30% off an Anova cooker. And I'm like, should I do it? But I still haven't really figured out my Instant Pot. So I don't think I'm going to take the plunge yet, but it's something I'm interested in.
Yeah. So if people listening don't know what it is, basically you take the food you want to cook. Like I do curry in these all the time. So I'll take my tikka masala sauce and chicken or cheese cubes or whatever, and you seal it in a vacuum bag. You put it in a big pot with water in it, and you put this little machine in the pot that brings the water to an exact temperature. So like, you know, like if you're cooking, let's say like a steak, and you want the temperature to be 140 degrees on the inside of the steak, your pan is super, super hot on the outside.
Yeah, your pan's like 400 degrees, hoping right. that you can transfer that heat to get the internal temperature to where you need it.
Right before you've burned the outside, you know? So right. what you do, like if you're cooking a steak sous vide, you set the water to be 140 degrees. You throw it, you know, the water never touches the food. It's all the food's in a vacuum bag. And so you throw the food in the 140 degree water and you can leave it there. Like it's done in 15 minutes, but you can come back 6 hours later and it's still exactly just as good. So one of the things I really like about doing that is I can have pre-made, you know, vacuum bags of different foods just sat in the fridge. I fill up a pot. I put the sous vide machine in there. I turn it on. And then whenever I feel like eating later, I just cut the bag open and it's ready to eat. So
I'm recording. If you're now I'm recording. I just started recording. So, you know, we'll probably be using the Zoom audio at least until this point, if not for the whole show. But, you know, if you hear something, that's why. I'm so sorry. but so you cook the thing, then you have the juices and the food, and then you like throw that onto a pan, right?
You can, you don't have to. It depends on what you're cooking. Like, you know, what I do a lot too is I actually have a blowtorch in the kitchen. So like I will take asparagus is one of my favorite things to cook sous vide. I'll take a vacuum bag. I'll throw some butter, some seasoning, whatever in it, throw it in the pot, let it cook. And then I dump the asparagus out onto a plate and take the blowtorch just to sort of like crisp it up on the outside. You do the same thing with steaks. You do that with other things like that. But for like curry, I just basically you just throw it into a bowl and then it's ready to eat.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking more for steaks. You know, I don't trust blowtorches in food. Like it just doesn't seem like the right way to do it. I'm certainly the science has already come back and it's fine or whatever, but something to me just rings bad about it. I don't know. Like, it doesn't seem like it works out. It just on paper, it seems like it's like a cheat. Like it looks it right, is. But isn't like texturally what you'd want a char to right. look like on a steak or something.
If you want it to be more authentic, what you do just before you pull the food out is you take like a cast iron pan, you heat it up as hot as you can get it, and then just throw that on there real quick just to be able to char it on the outside.
Yeah,
and that works just as well. I'm just lazy and I use the blowtorch.
Well, a lot of people do, and it's like, you know, I watch a lot of Instagram food videos or TikTok food videos and stuff, and you know, they come up a lot because they look cool and stuff, and you know, there's a presentational element. It's certainly probably the only way to make crème brûlée and stuff, but you know, yeah, it just seems like more of a gimmick and stuff, but I don't know. I haven't experimented with it, so I could be way off base.
A lot of my cooking, so, I don't know. I'm weird in that, like, I'll be hungry when I start cooking, but by the time I finish cooking, I just don't feel like eating anymore. So like everything I do is based around that weird quirk of me. So like I have one of those really nice Japanese rice cookers where you throw the rice in, you throw the water in, it's all like an induction bowl. You close the lid, you hit start, and then you can come back 6 hours later and it's still just perfect rice. So like I do curry a lot where I'll do sous vide, curry sauce and whatever protein I'm throwing in there. And then I throw some rice in and just come back 4 hours later and eat.
Yeah, that sounds really good. I don't think I consume enough rice to really have like a regular rice cooker, but I think about it all the time because, like, you know, like in a lot of Asian households, they just have a rice cooker that's just going, you know, and they just have the rice and it's just always heating like all day, you know, and they'll do that for a couple weeks. You know, the food doesn't last that long. I'm sure they're eating it faster, but it's just as opposed to, you know, you just have the rice there at the ready. And I would be, you know, having rice just be like, I could eat some rice. Sounds like an amazing, you know, thing to have going on, especially if you have proteins and stuff. I don't cook with a ton of uncooked meats, more just because my kitchen's cluttered and I don't want to worry about cleaning the kitchen after like the meat, you know, preparation and stuff. So I don't use a lot of meat when I'm cooking, unless it's like pre-cooked somehow. But I want to do more because obviously I like meat and I like cooking and I like cooking meat, but I just, you know, whatever. But yeah, I don't know.
Do you think you could ever do the vegetarian or vegan lifestyle?
I don't think so. I mean, if I had to, I could do it like for health reasons or something, but I think in general it's just like I specifically chicken. Like I think I could go no beef, probably no pork, but I think like chicken is just so good. Like I don't know how I'd live without, you know, even just like kind of like a boiled chicken breast or something. Like it's just so good to me.
For a lot of my life, I was vegetarian because I had a misdiagnosed beef allergy. Like I'm somewhat allergic to beef, but we couldn't figure out what it was. And all the best we could do was meats make you sick, so stop eating meat. Is kind of like from like high school into my 30s, I just had no meat whatsoever because I was getting sick all the time.
Did you get bitten by that tick, the Lone Star tick or whatever that causes meat allergies?
Not to my knowledge, no. It looks like I'm missing some enzyme in my stomach that most other people have, which is the real cause of it. So it's not really an allergy. It's just an intolerance.
Beef erase.
Like I can eat whatever I want in small doses, you know, which you can't really do if you have an allergy like that. But I still don't eat much. It's just I was eating very unhealthily because I wasn't able to eat what I wanted. So I just ate junk food all the time. You know, so that's yeah.
What else? Any last food thoughts? I don't know. I'm just trying to think. Yeah, I was gonna say that one of the things I like doing like as a hobby, like a hobbyist, is like scientific cooking, where it's not like I gotta put dinner on the table. It's more like there's this dish, it's interesting, I would like to try and make it, to learn about it without needing to eat this right now. So it's like if I really fuck it up, I could just throw it out, no harm done, you know. I'm not worried about, because that's what it's about. It's about learning how to do it right. And you know, it's like a project cooking. And then, you know, once I get a recipe down, I'm like, you know, this is great, now I have this in my holster. It's like, but one of my bags of tricks, like this Instant Pot risotto, I'm just like, knowing that I can just bust this out at any time is like a huge boon to me. But you know, if that was just the only thing I was eating, I don't even know if I'd trust myself to make it, just because what if this goes bad, you know. But I don't know, when the America's Test Kitchen or whatever first started being invented, like I worked at a bookstore at the time, and there were like people were starting to just ask about American Test Kitchen books and stuff. I was like, I'd love to do that, just to like, you know, like I wish I had resources, because it costs a lot to get a bunch of ingredients, but like I would love to just make 12 different batches of chocolate chip cookies just with mild variations. That's one of the things I've done. One of the things I did was I made chocolate chip cookies without the chocolate chips. Because I think the brown sugar cookie dough is so amazing, and the more chocolate you add, it kind of just hides how good the brown sugar. Obviously chocolate's great and whatever, but it's like it kind of just masks the flavor of the brown cookie a lot of time. And it's like, but I love the brown cookie, so I made it without. Really good. One of the things I settled on was I'll put three to five chocolate chips. I'll press it into the top of the cookie, and I'll kind of also shape it a bit into a more cookie shape before I put it in the oven. And then that's like the best, because you do get enough chocolate where you're not like, oh, this isn't a chocolate chip cookie, but it's really, you know, it's about the presentation. It's about the brown sugar cookie dough coming through, which is just so, it's just so good to me. I don't know. And so like, I tried a bunch of variations on that, and you know, I So I mostly just make them normal style now, but you know, it was fun to figure out all these different ways to do it. I don't know. That's just, you know, I love science. When I was a kid, me and my parents would quote do science in the kitchen, where we basically just squirt a bunch of liquids into the sink, you know, like ketchup and stuff, and mix it around and see what happened, you know. And I feel like it kind of spurs from that tradition, where it's just like, yeah, let's just see what happens. I'm not going to eat any of this, we're just doing science, you know. But yeah, I think it's you know, I think it's a privileged thing to be able to do, obviously, to not be all like, oh yeah, I have to, you know, not, I, it doesn't matter how this succeeds or fails. I don't have these ingredients. I'm going to buy them at a store just for this that I'm probably, you know, I might not even eat, but it's a very fun approach for me. All right. So I asked about your life update. I don't think I ever gave my life update. So when last we met, well, before last we met, when I had Simon on, when I had Simon on and did my best conservative commentator impression, if that's your viewpoint of what happened, I mentioned that I had high blood pressure, and then I had to test my blood pressure during the show, and it was like 175 over 140, which people told me that's really bad. That's crazy bad. Go to the hospital. That's bad. You know, which I know. When I saw that number, I was like, that's a horrible number. But in my mind, I was like, okay, that's wrong. There's something's wrong about this. There's no way this is an accurate result or something. Like, something is happening. I don't really have this blood pressure. So, you know, maybe my blood pressure is really high, but it's not quite that high. I know that. So I didn't freak out at the time, but people were like, you got to worry about this. But so yeah, that's what happened, is that I was like, okay, clearly something went wrong. I ended up going back to the doctor who originally prescribed me the the blood pressure medication. He tested my blood pressure again. He said it was too big. I told him, the fucking medicine you gave me made me feel like I was having a heart attack. I don't want to take it any again. And he was like, well, what if you took less? And I was like, I mean, no, but fine. Okay, fine. It seems like a terrible idea to me. But so he doubled my dose of the heart pressure heart medication and halved the dose of the brain medication. So I started taking both again. Pretty quickly, I was starting to feel fucked up again. And I was like, I know this was going to happen. So as it happened, Anthem or whatever, is it Anthem? Yeah, Anthem, my insurance provider, they called me with a courtesy call from a nurse practitioner, because I guess it's part of their standard coverage, or, you know, whatever. It's their research that this saves the money. After I go to the ER, they'll call as a follow-up and just see, you know, figure out what's going on, see if they can help or anything. And I talked to the nurse practitioner. I basically told her what was up. I was like, I've seen this crazy doctor. I don't trust him. He put me on the medication. I thought it was going to kill me. He put me back on it even after. I was like, that doesn't seem like a good idea. And, you know, we just talked it through, and, you know, she just listened, and she gave me a bunch of advice. One of the things she said to do was to bring my blood pressure machine to the doctor and give them to give me a reading, and then you wait a little bit, and then I take a reading with my machine and see how close to each other they were. And so I was like, oh my God, that's an amazing idea. So I did. I also told my doctor about what had been happening. He's my general practitioner. And the lady told me, you know, she explained to me that, like, you know, part of what the general practitioner is supposed to do is just understand everything that you're doing medically. They don't necessarily involve themselves with all of it, but they have, like, oversight, and they might be able to point you in the right direction to this or that, you know. So I didn't really think about that before, but so yeah, I went in like pretty soon after and just basically told him the whole story I told her. And, he, you know, he was like, yeah, you shouldn't go to that doctor anymore. And I was like, I know. And, he, you know, we talked about cardiology, and he said he thought he could get me a faster cardiology appointment than I had previously booked. And he did. And, he said I should do a sleep study, because if I had sleep apnea or some sort of sleep problem, that could cause high blood pressure and some of the other symptoms you're talking about, with focus and motivation, which is one of the reasons why I pursued ADD in the first, or ADD diagnosis in the first place. And so I was like, yeah, whatever. And so I got a sleep study consult. I went to the cardiologist. Everyone still seems to be, you know, thinking that probably what happened is, you know, it was a reaction to the medicine. But they took my blood pressure, and then I took the blood pressure with my machine, and it was off by like 40 points. And wow. So I had been like rigorously documenting my blood pressure like for 2 weeks. And then, you know, it's like, well, it's impossibly inaccurate. Like, none of this data means anything. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm done. And so now every couple of days I'll go to the local pharmacy where they have like one of those big sit down blood pressure, and I'll take mine there just to get a baseline, but I'm not even tracking that too heavily. But cause my blood pressure is pretty consistent. It doesn't change very much. It's just not, you know, it's stage one, I think, hypertension, or maybe pre-hypertension, one of the two. And so it's not, you know, it's not great. I'd like it to be better. But then also I have concerns about my heart in general. Like, one of the reasons I stopped smoking pot is because I felt like I was getting heart palpitations occasionally if I smoke pot. And it's like, and both my parents had SVT, which is a rhythm kind of problem with your heart, I think. It makes your heart beat way faster, I believe. And so, like, both of my parents had heart problems. My grandpa had heart problems. So it's like, I really want to figure out if there's any possible thing going on with my heart, you know, and just know that at the very least. So yeah, the cardiologist is going to test me in a week or two with a stress test and an echogram. And I took this sleep study, where they gave me this device that you wear it on your head. It's like this weird kind of miner's headlight style headband, like with a big battery thing situation. It has like a breathing tube where you put it into your nostrils. I don't know. I think that's supposed to measure your oxygenation levels or something. I don't know. And what you do is you put it on, you have to use Band-Aids, or in my case, duct tape after I ran out of Band-Aids, to tape the tubes to your face so the nose piece doesn't fall out. And then you go when you're like, you can't get up, and like, you got to basically sleep right after you turn it on. So you got to be like really ready for bed, and you went to the bathroom and everything, and you lay down with the thing on, you look at the ceiling, you turn it on, and it says like, unicorder recording, don't move, look up at the ceiling and don't move, it's calibrating or whatever. And then it's like, calibration complete, you may now go to sleep. Which is like, you think I was going to fall asleep in like the 3 seconds it took to calibrate the machine? That's so weird. But then, you know, the voice is pretty loud, and it's supposed to be loud because if while you're sleeping, your tube comes off or one of the electrodes on the headband comes detached, she'll say like, wake up, wake up and fix your damn tube or whatever. Like, It was very strange. And so I had to do that for 3 days. And the other thing is, you have to do it for 3 consecutive days. And also, it only has storage for 3 days. So you can only, like, if you had a bad night where it's like it fell off and you slept through it or whatever, it's just like, okay, we just lose that day of data. Like, and then you just got to cover it with 2 working days of data. And then maybe if it's so bad, we'll rent it to you again. The thing costs $400, which is like, when you look at it, it's like, this is a piece of shit. Like, this is like at best $50 like of electronics. And it was designed in like 2014. So it's like, it's just a piece of shit. Like, it really was bad looking. Like, when I looked at it, I was like, you know, I'm not like an inventor, but I would have done a way better job making this thing, you know, but maybe they wanted it to be cheap or something. Anyway, I did that. I turned my thing back in, and then I went and got a heart monitor because the heart doctor wanted me to wear a heart monitor for a week. So now I have a heart monitor glued to my chest. And that's interesting. It's just, I'm finally starting to get used to it. This is my second full day of 7 days that I've been wearing it, and it's fine. It's just a bit weird. They said, oh, so just so you know, in the first 24 hours, you can't shower or bathe. And I was like, yeah, not a problem. And then they were like, and you know, if you want to bathe, you got to follow these steps. And I'm like, yeah, no, I just, you know, too much trouble. I'm just going to go a week, you know, without bathing. The doctor said I could do it. And so I have the heart monitor, and I think I actually have a stress test later this week. So I hope I don't sweat off the heart monitor or something. They said that they can't answer any questions about the heart monitor, and I have to call a number for the manufacturer if I have any questions. And then so, yeah, because, you know, it's not their machine, I guess. But if it falls off or stops working, basically you just mail it back to them and they'll mail you a new one. And then you keep going for the remaining time, which it's like a weird clunky process. But yeah, so I hope that doesn't happen, just because I like to just get it over in a week and then be done with it, you know. But so that's been my health journey so far. Hopefully we'll figure out if I have SVT or if I have anything going on with my heart or if I'm just a hypochondriac, which is probably the most likely scenario. It's just, I don't know. I've read a lot of stuff about weed causing heart problems that scientists hadn't really correlated before. And so it's like, if you have heart problems already, weed can be a lot more dangerous than people assume. And then also weed can cause heart problems if you're using it really heavily. And I've smoked really, really, really heavily for 15-ish years at this point, you know, I guess 14. But so like, like a lot. And so like, if there's ever a candidate for something to go wrong, you know, I feel like it could be me because of my parents' heart history and stuff. I don't know. But that's been my life update. So yeah, I was a bit belated, but, yeah, so I guess it's time to break into our favorite, famous freaking the segment. You know it. You love it. It's the one I can never remember the name, because it's like, it's the news corner. It's like Spencer's news. I don't know. I don't know. But it's time for that. Happens. Yes. And I'm dancing to music. And if you're not hearing the music, it's not intentional. That's right. In today's news, the Nazis are at it again. How are the Nazis at it again anyway, Kevin? Do you have any ideas? I don't know.
I haven't seen any Nazi activity. I saw a truck with a Nazi flag on it at LAX. Wow. That seems like a bad place for that. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the Nazi symbol is not good. It's on my pans list, my list of critical pans. But yeah, so that Nazi was at it again. I hope bricks get thrown through his car. And that's the news.
Oh, I don't. Oh, I do.
And now I'm dancing to non. Okay, now the music has started. But if you're tracking through, dancing. A second. Yeah. There we go. And that was the news corner. We don't have too much time left. It looks like Jeff is calling in, but yeah, I think we got some more work to get through before we can talk to him. I don't know. Should I talk about my Patreon? Do you think that's a good idea?
I do. I think there's been a lot of demand for it. You've been hyping it for, you know, however many episodes this has been now. And yeah. There's demand. There's definitely demand.
I don't know. I just have such a fear of failure. Like if I launch this Patreon and it goes nowhere, it doesn't cost anyone anything, you know, but I'll feel such a devastating loss that like I've been paralyzed by thinking about that. But yeah, as you know, I'm trying to build a Spytreon. We're creating spite on Patreon, you know, that's the stuff. So we're trying, as you probably know, Jeff has a Patreon. I think it's called Knight and Davis. You can find it on his, you know, he has links to it on his profiles and stuff. But despite him, I'm trying to make a Patreon that just proves that we're better than him. You know, the goal is to get more money and to get more patrons than his Patreon to fucking stuff it to Jeff. And if that happens, aha, that's the podcast drink, etc. I don't have a drink. Actually, I think I have like birthday flavored soda over there. There's a couple drinks that we haven't drank for the show that I found somewhere. But yeah, so if we do that, I think I got to figure out some sort of prize for all the Patreons to celebrate that we've successfully spited Jeff, you know? But I don't have any ideas for that, but that's separate. So let's talk about the tears. And this is just, I don't know. The thing is, people are going to give me advice and I'm going to get so mad at the advice people give me because I'm a thin-skinned, whiny piece of shit. And, you know, they'll be doing nothing but helping me and I'll get so upset. But don't let that stop you or do. Like, I don't know. You know, hopefully have good ideas. Like people, I love advice from people, but most people who want to give me advice have bad advice, you know? So it's like, be good. Give good advice if you want to give advice. Anyway, so there's a $3 tier. I think most of these are matched with what Jeff is doing, so Jeff has a $3 tier that's just nothing. So I also have a $3 tier that's just nothing. But you know, you get the satisfaction of knowing that you're spiting Jeff. You know, your $3 is going to absolutely spite Jeff as hard as possible. And then you have a $5 tier. This is like the real, real tier. And so this is like, this kind of gets a little bit away from the idea of spite because you can't just have a Patreon where it's like, just give me money and nothing will happen, you know? So the $5 tier is supposed to be a real tier. And my idea is like at least once a month, I'm going to try and release some sort of D&D related something. Like maybe it's me talking about and pointing to art from, or pointing to like my notes from older Harmontown or even Harmon Quest episodes. I have every season of Harmon Quest, I have this little notebook that contains the whole adventure. And so it's like, maybe I'll talk you through that. I want to like write little scenarios, like not a full-blown dungeon, but maybe a single dungeon room or a puzzle or an encounter, a character option. So like once a month, kind of my plan is to release something like that. It's probably not worth $5 if we're being honest, but I think over time, like you'll be like, maybe some of this can be useful or, you know, let it inspire you in some way. In preparation, I've already written the first one, which is the Cult of the Big Cool Eye is like a power group in this campaign, the That Happens campaign. I don't think they've really come up, but people have mentioned them. They've been like, the Cult of the Big Cool Eye. And so I made a warlock patron character option for the Cult of the Big Cool Eye. So if you wanted to be in the Cult of the Big Cool Eye as a warlock in your D&D campaign, this is the character option for that. It focuses on gaining magical powers that are focused on your eye, and the eye gets bigger and cooler as you progress and level through the cult. And so, yeah, I think it's a cool release. If I could do everything with that level of quality, I would be really impressed with myself. I don't know if I could do that, but you know, who knows? You know, like all Patreons, it'll probably fall off. But that's a $5 tier. At $20, which is, again, I think this is probably a ripoff of Jeff's tier. I don't know. Well, maybe this one's not. But in addition to that, also you can you can send me like, here's what I'm doing in my campaign. And then I'll like write you probably like one page or maybe more of like just ideas, me talking through, like, it's not like a live consult, but you send me this, I'll give you notes on it. I don't think that's very valuable to most people. Whatever, this tier might get completely destroyed for $20. Like, who's going to do? Well, you know, first of all, I don't expect you to do this every month. Oh, every 20, you know, I'm going to pay $20 every month to send Spencer this, you know. But you know, if you ever had a thing, maybe you kick me $20 one month and downgrade, and then, you know, I'll give you notes. I don't know. You know, like I said, maybe this one goes out the window. At $50, I think this is what Jeff did too, is you get the cameo tier where I'll do like a cameo style video for you once a month. Again, who the fuck wants that? I don't know. People have asked me for cameos, but I don't believe they would pay, you know, even $10, $20 for those. I mean, if you do, great, more power to you. But certainly no one will pay $50. So maybe the price of that might change. I don't know. It's just like the idea of whatever. And then at $100 a month, this is another ripoff of Jeff's thing, is I will Zoom you to do like a brainstorming session about D&D, or we could talk about a D&D related topic, or I guess we could talk about other stuff. Maybe I'll try it. Maybe it's for 30-ish minutes is what I'm saying. It could be more, but I don't want to commit to like, oh yeah, we'll talk to for a fucking hour. It'll be great. I don't know. But you know, maybe if you want to learn D&D, I could teach you D&D for 30 minutes or something. I don't know. We can figure it out. Jeff has a tier that's like, I think he'll Zoom call you once a month or once every something. So it's kind of like a mirror of that, but it's like maybe more D&D folks, but you know, I'm open for shit. This is another ripoff is the $250 a month tier is, I'll play D&D with you as a player. Jeff has this, you know, and just like Jeff, I will also use Bone Weevil's character sheet from Harmon Quest. That's the Jeff Davis guarantee. And to spite him, I'm also guaranteeing that, but of course you don't have to have me do Bone Weevil's character sheet. I don't know, whatever. So, you know, if you wanted me to play D&D in your campaign, not DMing for you, you know, that's the thing. Again, I don't expect anyone to do this, whatever. And then the very top, again, no one's going to do this, but this is ideally the crown jewel of the Patreon is for $500 a month, I will DM your party for one session a month. I will DM you using an adventure module, pre-made content, not homebrew stuff. If you want homebrew stuff, I'll probably have to charge more. We could talk about that. I don't know. But yeah, so that's again another big thing. But I want, you know, people, there are professional DMs. They usually charge very low rates, you know, but some of them, the premium people charge, you know, around this amount of money. They charge a lot of money. It's more money than I'm comfortable charging. But at the same time, I don't want to be in a position where it's like there's all these D&D games and I'm not making enough to make it worth it, but I've just said I will do this thing and I just bogged down. Like, that just seems like my own nightmare living hell. So I don't want to do that. The prices of all of these, but especially these top ones, are probably going to change because, again, I want to value my time as a D&D person, but what I think the value of that time is more than I want to be charging. So it sucks, but $500 is like my starting compromise. It's like, I would like to charge a little bit more, but I could never ask, you know, if like you have a 5-person group, that's 100 people per group or $100 per group for just one session a month. I don't know. But so maybe, I don't know. And if this isn't interesting to anyone, fine. I maybe I won't do it. I don't know. I do think, you know, maybe the $5 tier with the D&D content might be worth it. I don't know. It depends on how many people go for it. Maybe I can up the price of that and do a little bit better, because I can imagine, you know, if I had a little bit more effort to expend into this, and that was kind of, you know, imagine a world where my full-time job was coming up with Patreon content for D&D, you know, players, DMs to use, you know, I could probably do a better job. But, you know, juggling it between a bunch of stuff, like for it not to generate a ton of money, you know, I probably can't devote I don't know. All of this to say, it's probably a bad idea. I that's why I've stalled out on the project. I was going to launch it like a month ago, but I just like got self-conscious about this whole thing. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm still not sure I'm going to, but just to talk about it, I have talked about it. So let me know what you think. I will try not to get mad at you, at least externally. I will be furious internally, but hopefully that won't spill on to any of you. That's the Patreon. And now it's time for what everyone wanted, my big full-length interview with Kevin. Well, that's actually what this episode is a full-length interview with Kevin. Man, this episode hasn't been very funny, huh? It's not like there's been no jokes, but mostly it's been real nuts and bolts talk on food and such. You know, it's been pretty straight, so whatever. But yeah, so Kevin, tell me about your early life.
I was born in Baltimore, Maryland. I moved to Nebraska when I was 5. Mm-hmm. I lived in Nebraska until I was 19 and moved to Chicago when I got a job at Midway Games to be a video game designer. That wasn't initially what I started there for. I was started there just as an IT guy, but kind of quickly moved over to doing game work.
So what kind of game design did you do? Like coding or what?
Yeah, I was primarily a programmer. I started out doing, Midway had this line of touchscreen games, like, you know, and the sitting on top of a bar, like it's got trivia and card games and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I did Midway's version of that. So
that's cool.
Designed the whole like kind of operating system for it and the graphics and the sound and all that.
We have. we'll have to get back to that interview. You know, like I said, I was planning on interviewing Kevin the whole episode, or at least a big majority of the episode, and I think we should try and do that at some point, because Kevin's the most interesting person by far in this combination of people, and certainly the most powerful, and we really want to figure out what's going on with him, what Kevin's deal is. I'd like to do it. I kind of wanted to talk again about the health stuff. I did want to talk about the Patreon stuff, but I knew that wouldn't last, so I'm glad we could find enough food stuff to talk about. But yeah, that's the show. That happens pod on all the things. Go with God, shit with Satan, smoke back salt, and have a good foot.
Hi, everybody.